With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap with Mike Donahue. Mike, how are you?
Terrific. Thanks, Andy.
That's good. As always, you can sign up for the podcast and subscribe to the newsletter. There's a sale for Free Agent Frenzy. 20% off, I think, until Thursday. Let's see, recent podcasts that you might want to check out. We did the 2011 Cubs last week, which was a terrible team and a fun podcast. There's also a double interview podcast with Kevin Kadick and John Greenberg, where Kevin and I talk about Chuggo, and John and I talk about all kinds of stuff. And then there's a new baseball podcast with Dave Brown from Valley Sports, and I have managed to sucker Dave in to joining the baseball podcast on a regular basis.
Sucker!
And Kyle Reichert is going to do... He's apparently a busy boy.
Kyle is?
Yes. So he's going to do it occasionally.
Well, you know.
You know, whenever he doesn't have a date, I guess.
Right. When you're
what? He's a handsome boy, so he's probably not going to be around much.
When you're in your, what, he's still in his 20s, right? Kyle's a young kid.
Oh, yeah, he's young.
Living somewhere vaguely east of Ashland and, you know, whatever, north of Armitage and west of the lake and whatnot. Who knows what your schedule is going to take you, so.
So you can check all those out, and that's about it. All right, so it's time to spin the wheel of crap and see what year we end up with.
Yeah, and just to preface it, in case anybody's just stumbled in here, we've done 15 seasons between 1980 and 2012, our predefined set. And, you know, some people might accuse us of rigging it for whatever reason, God only knows, that would be, but in some sort of a mystifying sort of a occurrence that in 15 spins in 32 seasons, only one of the 10 years of the 1980s has ever been pulled. And even that was just barely in the 80s. And it was a fun season. It was 1989. And it's just a peculiar twist of fate that we have so much, I guess, material to unearth that just hasn't, it's been distributed very heavily towards the mediocrity by design, the Tribune ownership of the 1990s basically have just been scorched. And we've even done quite a bit of the aughts, and we've even done a Ricketts owned season, but we haven't done a Wrigley owned season, which, you know, they're both part of this collection. So, you know, we've brought it up before, and I think the more we bring it up, the less likely it's going to happen, but at some point we're going to get to them. And if I were a betting man, Andy, and if our sponsor of course did have a line on this, I would definitely throw something down on a year in which the third number was 8.
Third number was 8? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, looking at the spin slow, the wheel slowly spinning by, you know, there's so many 80s, all but one, and there's a lot of aughts. Those are overwhelming. Yeah. The 90s are almost gone. Just two left.
I believe two. Yeah.
Three.
If you're a big
90, 93, 95.
90, yeah, we haven't done 90 also. Good point. Yeah, that's a forgettable one. Heaven forbid if it falls on that. And it probably will because, again, probably jinxed it.
Oh, you bring up a good point. I'll dump the ad in here as a bonus to our great sponsor, DraftKings Sportsbook. But they're running a thing through, and they're running a special because Illinois reopened online signups last week or 2 weeks ago now.
Meaning what? That you don't have to go to a casino to create an account?
You just download the app on your phone, and your little GPS will tell them that, yes, they're actually in Illinois, and then you can just sign up. And if you use the promo code Pointless, place a $5 bet, and you get $200 worth of bets. Look at that. You get a 20 times return. Is that right? Did I do the math right?
Whatever. That's a no-brainer for me.
That's a 40 times return.
It's a no-brainer for me as a co-host. It's free money. As someone who has, up until this very moment, seriously resisted the urge to place any bet outside of maybe a two-year period in the early 90s with a bookie in DeKalb or whenever my feet were planted in the state of Nevada. Yeah. Even though it's legal, I've resisted it. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, I just placed a bet. I bet they did a – what do they call them? I should know this. They did like an odds boost where they took Gonzaga as like minus 3,800 to win their first round game against, I don't know, Cal Poly Tech, whatever. They boosted the odds to plus 100, and you can bet you can bet up to $50. You're guaranteed to double your money unless it's the biggest upset in March Madness history. So I can't wait. It's going to be $100 in my account in a couple of days just for that.
So, use it.
All right. So we're going to spin the wheel. I'm ready to talk 80s Cubs. So let's hope we
let's keep our fingers crossed. I hope we can speak it into existence.
I made a Jerry Morales reference on the baseball pod and Steve Henderson.
Well, it wouldn't be the first Jerry Morales reference if it happened tonight either.
We're going to get one.
Finally. All right.
Jimmy Carter was president. The Miracle on Ice, 1980. So we'll talk about how Mike Arruzzioni that means eruption. And I think it's also Italian for Rizzo. And like Anthony Rizzo was the Mike Arruzzioni of the 2016 Cubs.
That's quite a connection. So Arruzzioni, you're saying, is supposedly Italian for eruption?
For eruption. And I just assume it's also Italian for Rizzo, because it kind of sounds like it. Actually, Ruzzioni's nickname, his hockey nickname, was Rizzo.
Yeah, I guess.
That was his nickname.
Was that something that Herb Brooks just sort of slurred after his 18th cocktail?
No, one of my favorite, and I know our buddy Frank Nova hates the movie Miracle, which I don't understand because I love Miracle. I think it's great.
It's a great movie, but it's sentimental hogwash.
It's sentimental. It's supposed to be sentimental. I think it's just really well done.
It is.
Of course, the most famous scene is Herb's speech. You know, if we played him 10 times, we might win 9. You know, you're born to be hockey players, every one of you. Go on out there and take it, whatever. I always like after that. So they're walking, the entire team is trudging down the hallway to get to the ice, and there's all the telegrams from well-wishers all over, including one of them who Herb reads out loud. It's some old lady says, "You beat those commie bastards." And we get ready to go on the ice, and Ruzzioni, the captain, turns and stands at the front of the line, and he taps every player on the helmet as they go by and says some form of, you know, "Go get them," you know, and uses their hockey nickname. And then, of course, he's left at the end.
Right.
And this guy, who I used to remember his name, is like one of the – he's the guy who helped put together the hockey team with Herb, not one of the coaches, one of the administrators. He yells Rizzo and reaches over and smacks him on the helmet before he goes out on the ice. I also thought that was just a nice little touch. And that's what always reminds me that was his nickname. So there you go. Tune in for baseball and you get a Miracle on Ice.
Well, but
you get a movie
you're not
about
wrong.
The Miracle on Ice podcast.
Well, you're not wrong. That did happen in 1980, right?
Did.
I mean, of course.
Gas prices were the same as they are now.
So they say. But also, five other things happened in 1980 that pertain to the Cubs, and just geez, and I'm going to say too, Andy, I know you've admittedly you've said this before, a little bit of a blind spot until maybe 82, 83. I'm a year older than you.
I was basically an infant in 1980.
Yeah. So let me first of all sort of prepare to, you know, strengthen my shoulders to, you know, embolden myself, right, to fact number one, take the home run crown that Dave Kingman had held with 48 homers and be the Jerry Martin and do my best to lead the team with, I believe, 23 the following year. That's fact number one for 1980. Number two, and I'm going to pull it up while we're on the broadcast. I was at a game in 1980 as an eight-year-old, and there's a story. I brought this up before in a Bears podcast because this is what we do. A game in which Steve Howe tried to throw me a ball while I was wearing a Walter Payton jersey. But in the very same game in 1980, I experienced, and I didn't realize this till 30 years later, but I witnessed my first ever lead-changing walk-off win by the Cubs, which was the result of a Bill Russell throwing error. We can dig that one up. I've got the physical scorecard that I happened to come across in my dad's house like 5 weeks ago, and I took a picture. And so if anyone wants to see it, they can. They can see how disinterested we grew in keeping score after about the fourth or fifth inning. So Bill Russell's game-ending gaffe is not recorded in our score card, but we will go over that. That's fact. That was fact number two. Number three, the Cubs went into the season with a new manager on by Labor Day. And folks, if you think about it, that's not common where a first year manager can't even make it through his first year. So we can explore the Preston Gomez era, and we will. I say with confidence, I'm going to go out on a limb, and I could be wrong. So this is one of my five facts that can be challenged, but I'm going to say that Jim Tracy made his debut as a Cub in 1980. And he wore number 20, and his number is retired, of course, as we all know, gold number 23.
Yep. Yeah, he did. And he debuted on.
Good. All right. And future.
July 20th, 1980, and the final game was September 30th, 1981.
And I've got a story to say about that, because I was also in the bleachers in attendance at that game, and there's a story that I'll relate. That one's a very pedestrian story. And the fifth fact about 1980, it was the final season of defending Cy Young champion Bruce Sutter, who I know at some points in the past this has been a point of contention for you, but I think we've talked about it before, and we'll talk about it again tonight because that's what we do. But
what a terrible trade it was!
But it wasn't really, because they sucked, it didn't matter, and Leon Durham was good and whatever. But we'll relitigate.
Ken Reitz was the key to that trade, I think.
I know it's not I shouldn't go be right, and that'll come up. Well, even though it's more of an 81 fan, but those are my five facts. In summary though, the 1980 Cubs were, it was really my first personal full season from opening day. I got into the Cubs late in 79 and couldn't wait for opening day. And it was a miserable damn season, and it didn't deter me from sticking with them through another miserable season after that. And, you know, all these ups and downs, I was hooked on a horrible team, but you know, and that's the fact, Jack. So let's roll. What do you got?
All right. So the first my first fact here is timely. So former Cub Scott Servais, who manages the Seattle Mariners, was complaining today about the rule that did you know there's a roster limitation this year in baseball?
Is it not 25 and before
it will
September
be, it will
1st?
Be, no, 26. Remember, they added the extra guy last 2 years ago?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Shows you how much I keep
and
up.
Negotiating as to they're going to start the season with extra guys because of the short spring training. Probably start with 28. But at some point, they're going to get back to 26. And at the 26-man roster, you are only going to be allowed to carry 13 pitchers. And Service is pissed. And he's going on and on. He says, horrible, terrible decision, blah, 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 blah. And I immediately made fun of it. I'm like, if you can't get by with an 8-man bullpen, what the hell are you doing? But how about this fact?
Scott
Servais wants more than 13 pitchers on his pitching staff all year long. How many pitchers did the 1980 Cubs use all season?
I'm going to take the under, Andy, and just say 12.
12.
Yes.
They used 12 pitchers in an entire season.
You hear that, DraftKings?
No, they were terrible.
Amy.
They won 68 games, but they only used 12 guys.
That's incredible.
Should I name the 12?
Oh, well, let's go through. We just got started here. Yeah.
All right. So four guys started at least 34 games.
Can I
guess? A different era. Who were the four guys who started? Okay. They started 38, 34, 41. Starts, because there were a couple of relief periods there. 38, 34, 37, and 27. Okay. Yeah. One guy only started 27 games. What the hell? Yeah. Rick Rushel was 11-13 in 38 starts.
Lynn McLaughlin. He's not the 27.
He made 12 relief appearances. So he made 27 starts.
Did Kruko make that many starts?
Mike Kruko made 34. He was 10-15.
Is it Dennis Lamp?
It is Dennis Lamp. 10-14 with a 5.20 ERA. They started 37 times. And he made 4 relief appearances just for the hell of it.
Well, I should also add that it was Dennis Lamp's last season, because after the season concluded, he had been dealt for Ken Kravec of the White Sox, who I think later came back to work for the Cubs as a scout. But Kravec seemed to have higher, what you might call a 1980 peripherals. We thought at Cub fans that we had robbed the Sox, because for whatever reason, you know, maybe Harry was going nuts about Kravec on the south side. There was something about Lamp. I don't know if it was like the foggy glasses or the bushy mustache, or like he never really like endeared, at least in our household. We never got too endeared to him. Like, we didn't really see what was so special. I was like, oh, Ken Kravec. We got Ken Kravec. And then Ken Kravec, I believe, went 1-7 in 1981. And Dennis Lamp almost threw a no-hitter in his first season with the Sox. One out in the ninth. He blew it, and then, of course, went on to have a very distinguished, sort of a weird middle relief career with the Blue Jays in the early 80s, in an era, I should add, in which loads of former Cub pitchers, many of whom were probably on the 1980 staff, if Bill Caudill's there, that's another one, of future dominant relievers that were like middling Cub pitchers. Willie Hernandez would also be one, right?
Yep.
Did Jay Howell happen to pitch on the 1980 Cubs, or is that too early? Okay. Howell's a no. There's somebody else in there I think you could root around, but anyway.
Well, the guy named Dirt was in the bullpen. Well,
yeah, but Tidrow himself was like this weird late 1970s version of a middleman, his first suitor, right? Did he actually – he didn't become much of a future closer. No.
He finished 38 games, but probably losses.
Well –
somebody's got to finish the losses. It was Dick Tidrow. He'd have 6 saves.
Did the 1980 Cubs have a...
Oh, Mike froze. So while Mike is getting his interwebs back, the Cubs actually had... I don't want to spoil this. I'll spring it on him. There's another closer in the bullpen that we don't think he said. The four starters, Rushel, Kruko, Lamp, and McLaughlin. I can never say Lynn's.
You have trouble with that one.
Oh, right. There's McLaughlin. All right. Yeah. So they had, two Hall of Famers in the bullpen and, two Cy Young Award winners in the bullpen.
Two Hall of Famers. Well, one of those is the same guy, right?
Well, he's not two. Yeah. Right. One guy was a Cy Young Award winner and a Hall of Famer.
Bruce Sutter, and the other bullpen Hall of Famer.
Yeah,
is this a trick question?
No,
or am I just
no? Is he the Cubs' all time leader in saves? I've lost track.
Oh, Lee Arthur Smith.
Lee
made
Arthur
his
Smith.
Debut in
yeah, 22 years old,
yeah.
18 Holy games, shit. Finished 6th. And then, of course,
you know what?
Of course, Guillermo Willie Hernandez was an American League MVP and Cy Young Award winner for the Tigers just 4 years later.
Incredible. Just 4 years later. Oh, my God. That is kind of an incredible thing that I hadn't considered, considering how well I'll just randomly recall some of those things, is that I hadn't really considered that Lee Smith was also a part of that team with Bill Caudill and Dennis Lamp. And, wow, Willie Hernandez. Think of the career. I mean, Hernandez didn't have a long career. He did have that incredibly, you know, white hot season of 84. But you wonder how many career saves were in that book. Because even I'm sure Dennis Lamp, you know, vultured about maybe 40 or 50 saves in his career.
Willie had an interesting season. He was 1-9 with a 4.40 ERA. He finished 13 games. He gave up more hits than innings pitched.
He only struck out
75. Let's see. Willie was 1980.
Willie had been around for.
He was 25. It was his fourth season.
Jesus. So that means he was 29 when he burst out of nowhere at the. Okay.
Yeah. So in 84, he was 9-3 with a 1.92 ERA. He pitched in almost half the Tigers games, pitched in 80 games. He finished 68 of them. Both of those led the league. He had 32 saves. Struck out 112 and 140 innings out of the bullpen as the closer. Good Lord.
It's crazy. It's a crazy thing when you think about, because he's not a Hall of Famer, but he won an MVP in the same year. He didn't blow a save till the end of the season, if I recall correctly. And he showed up in Detroit. The Cubs didn't trade him to Detroit. They traded him to Philadelphia late the previous season for Dick Ruthven, who would oddly enough also be the Cubs opening day starter in 84. Mm. But it's crazy to think about, like, Hernandez, he's just floating around the 1980 Cubs and just this sort of, this sort of undefined amorphous glob of shit. I mean, this is a 94 lost team or whatever it was.
So
with like all these arms.
Yeah. Willie was drafted by the Phillies. The Cubs took him in the Rule 5 draft in 1976. And then stole him from Dallas. And then Dallas traded him back in 83 for Bill Johnson and Dick Ruthven. And then he got traded a year later in spring training with Dave Bergman to the Tigers for Glenn Wilson and one of the great names in Tiger history, Johnny Wackenfuss.
That's a Donruss baseball card memory if I ever saw one. Johnny Wackenfuss.
He had three really good years with the Tigers and then was pretty much done. But his arm fell off.
Okay.
Sparky pitched him every day.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, it's really bizarre to kind of see that. I mean, how many you could probably count on two hands the number of Cy Young and MVPs in the same year, I reckon. Maybe not two hands. Maybe a foot might have to be involved, but one of the guys that did it was an otherwise like happened to be like in the midst of a 3-year comet of a career that like began with just middling sort of work. And then, like you said, his arm was blown out, but yeah, Willie Hernandez, 1980 Cub.
All right. It has happened. I better check the date on this because it might've happened 11 times now instead of 10. Nope. It's happened 10 times in baseball history that a pitcher has won the Cy Young and the MVP in the same season.
10 times.
Let's see how many we've got.
So that was the, and I didn't realize that was the other side of the question was the other Cy Young was Guillermo Hernandez. Okay.
Yes. It happened first in 1956 by a Dodger.
Was it Don Newcomb?
It was Don Newcomb. And then it happened in 1963 by a Dodger.
Was it
the guy you would probably expect? Yeah. Sandy Koufax.
I almost said Drysdale. What the fuck?
Then it happened in 1968 by a convicted felon.
Oh, Denny McClain, Lou Boudreau's son-in-law. Yep.
It happened. Oh, how about this? It happened in both leagues in 1968.
Oh, Gibby, right?
Bob Gibson.
Wow. That's a fun fact.
Squared off in the World Series, and thankfully the Tigers won.
Even with their tax cheating. The last 30 game winner, we should add too.
Oh, here's a good one. I would not have known. I don't think I knew this. A Milwaukee Brewer did it in 1981.
Oh, Pete Vukovich?
No.
What?
Mike not Caldwell? Pete Vukovich. A guy who is not often
Moose
thought
Haas?
Of as a Brewer. He's more thought
of
as
Don Sutton?
No, as an A.
What the fuck? What are you talking about, Andy? What? You're going to torture me? You're going to tell
Raleigh Fingers.
In 81, he won both?
He did.
He was like, had to be in his like 30s, right? Because he was on the 72, 73, 74 A's. Holy shit.
He was the first relief pitcher in American League history to win the MVP.
Man, this is like reliever night, by the way. Which, you know, again, it fits because the 1980 Cubs.
Well, the best part of this is that he scores of them. It says many argued that Rich Gossage
should have,
who had a better ERA, more strikeouts per nine innings, and a better WHIP, should have taken either the Cy Young, the MVP, or both. And prick. So I'm really glad that
instead of that jagbag Gossage for the pennant winning Yankees in 81.
So then it happened in 1984 in the American League by Guillermo Willie Hernandez. 1986 in the American League.
Wait, Clemens?
Yep, the Rocket.
Really? I didn't readily know that he had captured MVP.
So there are, let's see, this is going to be the second former Cub to do it. 1992 in the American League.
1992 American League MVP and Cy Young.
He was pretty ridiculous that year. It was an Oakland A.
Dave Stewart? No, or Bob Welch? No, Dave Stewart. Wait, no, Eckersley.
These are former Cubs, yes.
Yeah, another former Cub pitcher, slightly later era that became a dominant reliever.
He had 51 saves. He led the league in WHIP, fewest walks per nine innings, and most strikeouts per nine innings.
So Eckersley was at his peak. What year was
it? So he didn't give up. He didn't give up any hits. He didn't walk anybody, and he struck everybody out. That's pretty good.
Eckersley actually got like statistically better after the Gibson home run. I think like he's like, "Fuck, I can't believe I did that. I will never make that mistake again. I'm just going to bear down more or something." Because
it happened in 2011. By a guy, these last two are guys who are still pitching. 2011 American League.
I got nothing.
He's married to a supermodel.
Oh, Verlander?
Justin Verlander.
He won an MVP, did he, huh?
He was 24-5 with a 2.4 ERA. Led the league at strikeouts, innings, and WAR. He edged out impressive offensive numbers by Jose Bautista and Jacoby Ellsbury for MVP. And the last time it happened was in 2014 in the National League by a guy who I intellectually know is a great pitcher. And because of his postseason failings, including my favorite National League Championship Series
game of all time.
I always just find it – I know Clayton Kershaw is a great pitcher. I just never think of him that way because he pissed away playoff games to the Cardinals.
Yep. In multiple seasons, if I'm not mistaken.
And I can still see his knees buckle when Rizzo hits the home run off of him in game 6.
It was like somebody punctured the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man after the, he just, yeah. It was after Hendricks got through that first inning. It was such a big game, and he was kind of the perfect opponent for the Cubs, I think, as it turns out.
Well, and then he had who was the little the Dodgers had the left fielder who had been homeless, Andrew Toles.
Andrew Toles, he flubbed one ball.
Ball
I remember
just clanks off his glove.
Yeah,
and Clayton ended up in the fetal position on the mound.
Yes.
I rewatched that probably last year, late in the season, when the Cubs were terrible, and I just wasn't, and I needed to watch something.
I've watched it in the past.
In my mind, I always thought it went. I got to double check, make sure it didn't. I always thought it went Kyle to Aroldis.
Kyle to it, but did. It didn't. Somebody finished the eighth. It wasn't Aroldis.
I gotta look this up.
Is this another Mandela effect? Like Mitch Williams did not walk the bases loaded in the ninth inning in 1989, which we've had to re-educate ourselves on.
Yeah, I agree with that. Now, I'm wrong. It was Aroldis. For some reason, I thought Carl Jr. appeared, but he didn't.
Not in that game.
No. Yeah, it goes right from Hendricks to Aroldis. Aroldis got the last five outs.
Yes, he did.
Dodgers got Dodgers. What, two base runners in the entire game.
Correct. Aroldis and Kyle faced the minimum. Three base runners. Kyle picked one off. Kyle himself got a double. No, wait. Wait, did Aroldis get two? I think Aroldis got two double plays, right? Because he came in. Kyle actually faced one over the minimum left with one out and a runner on. Aroldis came in the eighth, got the double play, and they got another one in the ninth. I think they had four base runners. I think Kyle got a double play and also picked the guy off. I think it was Tolles.
Aroldis got Howie Kendrick in a double play to end the eighth. And then, of course, famously, Yasiel Puig grounded into a double play. And Carlos Ruiz did not walk. He fucking struck out. That was bullshit. It was a bad
call. Oh, right. Right. No, no. Almost, yeah. So you're talking about when Kyle got pulled, right? Mm. Kind of similar to
that
the...
It was in the ninth.
Oh, in the ninth. My bad. All right.
Should have been 1-2-3. And the other thing I remember about that is the as good a job, and it's a good time to talk about Joe Buck since he's left Fox and will no longer be doing.
I saw that.
Will no longer be doing baseball of any kind.
Baseball, right.
The end of the game caught him by surprise because of the double play. Like they were kind of winding up and they were getting ready. They're doing the love, you know, it's 5-0. They can do the kind of, you know, beauty shots of Wrigley and the fans who are still shitting their pants, even though it's 5-0 because we're Cub fans.
Right.
And you're just waiting for something horrible to happen.
Right.
And all of a sudden there's a double play and it's over. And the Cubs have won the pennant.
Well, we brought this up before that they also won their division in 2003 with a double unexpected double play.
Yeah, one that Alex Gonzalez actually turned.
No, no, but...
We found that out, too. He had been taken out. Alex had been taken out of that game. Or maybe he didn't even start it because it was the second game of the doubleheader.
I think, right, that's what it was, because there's no way you would take him out.
Well, it's Dusty. Got to put my guys in. Put Ramon in.
Well, you mentioned the Dodgers game and Dusty. I'm going to say, first of all, that Dodgers, that pennant clincher you talked about, of course, is only the second most memorable Cubs-Dodgers game. The first, of course, involved Dusty Baker as a player. And I alluded to it. In my five fast facts to begin with, and would like to, I had the pictures on my phone and I couldn't send it to the press, so I actually texted you, Andy, the front and back of the and as you as you search for that, I'll find the actual date. And I'll just tell you to preface it. We sat as a family in the bleachers as guests of my dad's older brother, our Uncle Bud. Uncle Bud did not have children of his own and would periodically, sometimes once a year, you know, just sort of on and off, would make a gesture like treat my dad and his kids to the game. My mom was always invited, of course, but would always take full advantage of the opportunity to clear her house of all of the people that inhabited it and happily stay at home. And so typically when we went to Wrigley Field, it would be the five kids and my dad. And of course, even if it's at the benevolence of somebody else, it tends to make more sense if you have that many kids and you're largely middle class that you're going to sit in the bleachers because it's a lot cheaper. So, yes, I was an 8-year-old. In the bleachers when we went out to Wrigley Field. It wasn't my first Cubs game, and it's probably the first one that I remember with any sort of clarity, but it would be Sunday, May 25th, I believe, yes. So it wasn't as late in the summer as I had originally thought, but we got to the game early, of course, because you're in the bleachers, and there's, you know, I'm 8, my sister's 11, my other sister's 13, my brother's 15, you know, I don't know. We may not have all been there, but I was there, and I was wearing a Walter Payton jersey. And I brought this up when we did our Bears podcast. Who knows why I'm wearing a Walter Payton jersey? But hey, it's 1980. We weren't always out
because you thought
appropriate gear.
You knew that 18 years later, Kerry Wood would strike out 20 guys, and they would just want a bunch of people wearing random 34 jerseys standing, holding up K's. In the bleachers.
It.
Remember that? The guy was there was people in like Barkley jerseys and other odd 34s. Do you remember that?
Right.
He was handing out the K's and the jerseys. That. It was just strange.
Right. Yeah.
So you were ready.
Well, I think
you were just 18 years too soon.
Yeah, I had a premonition. I was just a little bit.
So who started? Because he didn't strike out.
Well, I don't remember who started. It's in that scorecard that we pretty much stopped keeping score about halfway
through. Rick Russell, not Paul.
Right.
The handsome Rick.
But before the game even started, and just this is a retelling, by the way, if you're one of these people in the Venn diagram that listen to our Cubs bullshit and our Bears recollections, I did, of course, only fitting, I brought this up in a Bears podcast because I believe the question, our very first Bears podcast, I would say, because I believe, because I think you asked what the first jersey that we owned was, and I think it was a Walter Payton, and I wore it to this Cubs game, and I had a glove, and I was standing on the bench in the third row or fourth row or fifth row trying to get a ball, and Steve Howe was pointing at me, and he tried to throw it, and it fell short, and I didn't get the ball, which is fine. And of course, it's 1980. No one's going to give it to me. All right. Game's over. I didn't expect it. We move on with life. And then the game happens. And it's early in the season. I think I'm looking now. I actually pulled it up just to fortify the facts. But the Cubs, the Dodgers, of course, were the Dodgers. Always been the Dodgers. They're the Dodgers then. They were 1 year away from winning the World Series in 81. They're perennial contenders, of course, and the Cubs were also the Cubs heading into the game, 16-19 record, and it was. And I have no recollections of the game except for the ending. And so, if you happen to find anything in the baseball reference that you want to comb through, now is your time, Andy. Before I'll bring my, I will circle back to my recollection at the last play of the game.
No, I have a comment about the other than the fact that Rudy Law. The first batter, you ever saw in a big league ballpark was Rudy Law.
It wasn't my first game. It's only the first game I remember.
The first batter you remember is Rudy Law.
Sure, right. I still don't remember it, though.
Bert Hooton started, former Cub Bert Hooton started for the
former
Dodgers.
Former Cub threw a no-hitter, for the Cubs.
Steve Howe blew the save. That's what he gets for,
Right, not throwing me the ball, right. And Steve Howe would win the Rookie of the Year that year, by the way, but not the MVP in Cy Young.
Yeah, so the typical.
I can explain it. I remember.
You remember
seeing
the ninth inning?
Well, I just remember the last play. So you can lead us up.
Well, the former heavyweight champion of the world led off with a grounder to third.
The white Mike Tyson.
Mike Tyson, and then something that happened all the time: Tim Blackwell got a double.
Had to be a windblown pop up.
Preston asleep at the wheel. Didn't pinch run for him. So Lenny Randle's single did not win the game.
I forgot also Lenny Randle was on this team.
So they had runners at first and third. Bill Buckner came up with a chance to win it. I'm sure the all, I don't know how many fans.
Right. Probably. Well, it was a Sunday in May.
27,000.
So 27.
So all 27,000 fans were chanting Billy Buck. And he flew out to left, but Lenny Randle advanced to second. So runners on second and third, and then you want to describe the final play?
I was going to say, I thought you were going to mention his name, but moment of silence for Larry Bittner, who
two eyes, two T's,
also pitched in a game, hits a grounder to Bill Russell at short. And when that happened, I just remember from the fifth row in the right field bleachers, seeing my dad stand up. Because, of course, you never, get up before the game's over, even if you're getting your brains beat in, unless there are extremely extenuating circumstances. And I just remember he stood up, we're out of here, and Bill Russell proceeded to take the ground ball, hit off the bed of Larry Bittner, which would be the 27th out and another victory for the Dodgers, and proceed to sail it over Steve Garvey's head, in which apparently Lenny Randle crossed home plate about a split second before Tim Blackwell. And the Cubs suddenly turned a loss into a victory, and they would propel them to God only knows what heights in the 1980 season.
68 wins. So actually a key play was the Buckner flyout, because if Lenny's on first instead of third, all it does is tie the game.
Good point. Lenny Randle, good heads up base running. Yep. So now that Lenny Randle has come up.
I wonder who the left fielder was for the Dodgers. Somebody asleep at the wheel.
While you look that up, I'm just going to quickly tell you that Lenny
Johnstone?
Randle. This was Lenny Randle's one and only season. It's not? All right.
Oh, it was Dusty.
I'm sorry. I was talking.
Way to go, perfect. Dusty.
What would he have done, though? Like, throw out Lenny Randle at second?
Well,
see. Yeah, why not? Because Tim Blackwell's not going to crawl home from third, even if you throw the ball.
And nowadays, it would say whether it was deep or shallow. Yes. It doesn't say. So for all we know, it was on the warning track, and Dusty had no chance. I like to think that it was he just
hey dude,
like did the Ricky Henderson where he like threw it like almost snap throw underhand.
Yes, yes.
Standing there telling all the fans, "I invented the high five." Shut up.
Yes. Oh.
Nobody cares, yeah. Dusty.
Yeah, not that day. But yeah. I forgot what I was going to say, but that's a valid. I'm glad you figured out. Well, I was going to. Yeah, no, that's perfect. I knew Dusty's name would come up. It's come up a couple times already, but.
So I believe I have determined through process of elimination that my first game was an 81. So I can save that for the 81. It's a memorable. Yep. It's a memorable day. It.
Telling you.
Another walk. Yeah. It was also a walk-off Cub win.
Oh, okay. Hey, look forward to that. And for all you listeners, we're just getting started here. Who knows? This might actually go sequential.
How about this? Not only was it also a walk-off win, it was due to a fielding error by the opponent. Instead of Bill Russell, Phil Gardner.
Excellent.
So, that when we spin to 81, you get the whole story about guys smoking dope in the stands and us leaving my mom at Woodfield and leaving the game early. There's all kinds of good stuff.
Sounds like an awfully similar experience from my day in the bleachers.
I guess what it shows is that era of Cubs, unless the other team gave them the win, they didn't win.
Certainly not in 1980. Yeah. You know.
They drew. Does it have the. It doesn't have the Pythagorean theory. Oh, it does. Oh, how about this?
It must.
Oh, they only won 64 games. They were 64 and 98. The Pythagorean, they should have won 68 games. That's why Preston got fired.
Fuck yeah. I did want to circle back because before you unearth the awesome fact that Dusty Baker allowed Lenny Randle to tag from first to second for the winning run, which really, yeah, how did that happen? I just want to say this was Lenny Randle's one and only season with the Cubs. I just know that from memory. I was into the, like I've mentioned this before, 1979 is off our radar. So I'll just quickly point out that I just somehow got hooked on the Cubs, probably after I got hooked on the Bears and that Vince Evans Vikings game that we broke down where like they kind of got me going. But it was in September when I was watching a Cubs game against the Pirates, and the Pirates would end up winning the World Series, and they were badasses, and there's this big black gold uniforms and coming to town with all their jewelry and just like with their swagger. And the Cubs in 79 were actually managed by Herman Franks, a borderline 500 team. And they just couldn't hold up. And I just remember sort of like, really being, into it. And even though the Cubs were pretty much on their way out and this, rotund Herman Franks getting all upset at a call that broke the wrong way and kicking dirt on the umpire, this and that and the other thing. And that was it. But that team, I always remember, was led off with Ivan De Jesus, which he had apparently done since being acquired in 1977, along with Bill Buckner for Rick Monday, the last center fielder for the Cubs who had significant playing time in four consecutive seasons in center field. But then all of a sudden in 1980, Lenny Randle was the leadoff hitter. I might be wrong. So I don't know if you're looking through box scores, but I feel like, who's this Lenny Randle guy? And was he mostly the third baseman? It was years later when I learned that Lenny Randle was the guy who famously in spring training beat the shit out of Frank Lucchesi, who years later would become a Cubs interim manager after Gene Stick Michael was fired. But otherwise, Lenny Randle, my first memory of him is a 1980 Cub who was there for exactly one season. Not a bad player, although if you look it up, I'm sure he had like a .313 on base percentage or something. He was also the guy, I should add, since this is the Lenny Randle minute, who you might see on 80s bloopers videos is the third baseman for the Mariners, who was trying to blow a slow rolling ball foul as it crept up the third baseline. So
Lenny Randle and the 80 Cubs hit .276, a .343 on base. He's only slugged .370.
343 on base, though. He was actually a good on base guy.
OPS, especially for for 1980.
Yeah.
Joe Morgan, we'd have walked more if we knew that you were supposed to. It's like, well, Joe, you did. You walked a lot. That's the biggest frustration people had with Joe Morgan's analysis was he didn't value the things that he did well.
Right. Which would celebrate him.
Yes. Like, you looked at his, if you listen to Joe Morgan talk about baseball and then you looked at his stats, you'd be like, what?
Exactly.
Like, why does him and Dusty with the base clogging bullshit.
Right. So Lenny Randle, actually kind of a Moneyballish player then.
So how did the Cubs get Lenny? Like, let's see what happened to him. How'd they get Lenny Randle?
God, Larry Bittner was batting third that day, by the way, in that game I was at. Where the fuck was Buckner was the number two hitter? Jesus Christ. Mike Vail was batting cleanup. Man. All right. I just rattled off some names. We don't have to worry about them again. Mike Vail was name checked. And then Jerry Martin was only batting fifth, even though he led the Cubs in homer that year with half as many as Kingman had the year before.
So this is weird. Lenny, I don't know what this meant. Purchased. I guess you could just buy somebody's contract from another team. He had been, in 1979, he got traded with a former Cub batting champion from the Giants.
Former Cub. Bill Madlock?
To the Pirates, yep. The trade was Lenny Randle, Bill Madlock, and Dave Roberts to the, not that Dave Roberts, to the
not,
Pirates.
No, right. Early, white Dave Roberts, by the way.
For Fred Breining, no. Al Holland, and Ed Whitson.
Okay, who pitched against the Cubs in the 84 playoffs.
And then he, during the season, he got purchased by the Yankees. And then the Yankees at the end of the season, he let him leave as a free agent. He signed with the Mariners, but then the Cubs, he signed with the Mariners on March 20th. The Cubs purchased him from the Mariners on April Fool's Day. he probably didn't believe it. Like, what?
So right before,
like,
the opener.
So you're like, well, he never played for the Mariners. Well, no. Because he was granted free agency after the 80 season, and the Mariners signed him again. And this time, they didn't sell him. They let him play until June 28th when they released him, and it ended his career. So his
what year was that?
82.
Okay.
Oh, so he played for a year and a half for the Mariners.
Okay.
Okay, so bringing up Bill Russell reminded me of something. And I wondered if maybe it was this. But looking at Bill's stats, there were a lot of opportunities. In one of Jay Johnstone's books.
A Temporary Insanity?
Yeah, or the other one.
I mean, you're the one guy who's read both of Jay Johnstone's books. I'm sorry, I've only read one. Oh,
there's three. I've read all three. Got them right over there. I had them when I was kids. I couldn't find them, so I bought them on eBay, and I even managed I bought the blue one and the orange. Yeah, there's different. I bought the ones, the exact style that I used to own.
You
and
that
was the third one. I don't think I've actually read. It's the last one he wrote. He's dead.
Of course.
You know, so he was a practical joker. And actually legitimately very funny.
Not a Ryan Dempster actual funny guy.
And one of the things that Jay wrote, his secret to being a good practical joker was to set up the joke and not feel the need to be there for the payoff and give it away. He would do these things. Like, he famously, Sutcliffe was struggling with the Dodgers, and Jay went in and cut the crotch out of Sutcliffe's underwear. So after a game, Rick pulled his underwear up, and he pulled it, like, all the way up to his chin. And Jay wasn't there. So Sutcliffe is sure it's Jay, and he's screaming at people in the locker room. And Jay's not there. So then he decides, well, couldn't have been Jay because he'd have been there. Jay's like, I'd long since driven home. I just heard about it. I'd like to hear the stories later about how people reacted. Well, one that he did stick around for was Bill Russell was having a bad bout in the field making errors. And I wondered if maybe this was one of those. DraftKings, a casino queen sportsbook, is officially live with mobile sports betting in Illinois, just in time to get in on all the college basketball mania. Right now, new customers can bet $5 on any tournament team to win their game and get $200 in free bets if they do. It's that simple. If they win, you win. Go down to Wrigley, sign up in front of the marquee. Go down to the UC, sign up in front of the Jordan statue. Go find a college campus and sign up on the quad. As long as you're in Illinois, you could sign up and bet from anywhere right from the palm of your hand. Head to the DraftKings, the Casino Screen Sportsbook app now to check out all the great promotions and features, including same-game parlays. It's safe, secure, and reliable. Best of all, you can deposit and withdraw your cash whenever you want. Download the DraftKings, the Casino Queen Sportsbook app now. Use promo code POINTLESS. Bet $5 on any college basketball team to win and get $200 in free bets. If they win, you win with promo code POINTLESS this week at DraftKings, the Casino Queen Sportsbook. 21 and older, Illinois only. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 1-800-426-2537. And before a home game, trace
it back, maybe.
Yeah, can't, because I wait till I read Bill Russell's error totals.
Is that why Mariano Duncan came along?
I think so.
Because he sucked too.
So during batting practice, or during infield, Jay took hazard tape and tape cordoned off the box seats behind first base at Dodger Stadium.
Hazard tape is the yellow police
tape. Yeah, like
tape.
Caution tape.
Yep.
And there were some fans there, and he handed out plastic hard hats and put up a sign that he had made that said, "Danger," or something like, "Look out for stray throws from Bill Russell." And he set it up, and Bill's taking infield, and he looks over, and all the fans have yellow hard hats on, and there's a sign warning them that Bill's about to hit him in the head with a throw.
Wow.
So that was funny. But here's where did Bill Russell? Here we go. So these, I got to find the error column. He played forever, so it goes off the page here. Starting in 1976, 28.
Starting in 76, was that his first year?
No, he'd been around since 69. 72, he played 121 games. He made, I should have started there. He made 34 errors. 73, he made 31 errors. 74, he made 39.
Wow.
75, he only made 11, but he only played 83.
Well, maybe Andy scorekeepers were a little more stringent.
28, 29, 31, 30. 80 was a good year for him. In 129 games, he made 19.
And, it's occurred to me that we're covering an era in which we've touched upon it before, that has been astonishingly like awful for shortstops on offense. So if you're not bringing anything, and Bill Russell not excluded, he was not some anomaly, right, that they're going to put up with. So was Mark Belanger making 30 years a year? Was Johnny LeMaster making 30 years a year?
I'm sure Ozzy wasn't. He would have been a Padre at the time, right? Or maybe not even yet. Yeah, he would have been a Padre.
He was a Padre until like 81 or 82.
That's why I don't remember who it was, but we had somebody who just was incredulous. Couldn't understand why I liked Sean Dunston so much when I was a kid. I look at Sean's numbers, he sucked. Yeah, but relative to the era, he didn't. Like, yeah, he didn't get on base, and he struck out a bunch, but he put up actual, like, numbers that most shortstops didn't. Like, he actually hit home runs, and he stole bases, and he drove in runs.
Right.
And,
well, Cal Ripken was really the sort of mold breaker there, right?
Right, but there were so few shortstops that were worth a shit on offense.
Right, well, that's my point, though. Like, then you assume they're just, like, freaking ridiculously rangy.
Yeah, and they were.
Men.
I mean, it's
none
it's
of them
like,
were? So not like, even just Bill Russell?
Well, I don't know. Like, Morgan was always complaining that Dave Concepcion wasn't a Hall of Fame.
Oh,
there's not a
Morgan's
fucking planet in the solar system that he's a Hall of Fame shortstop.
Of course not.
He couldn't hit,
right.
And he was just an average fielder.
Right.
Remember, he was the guy who supposedly perfected his arm was so weak that he would bounce the ball to first on the turf because he couldn't throw it all the way to first base. So he learned where to give Tony Perez a nice hop. And he would, like, bounce it right before the dirt cut out so it would bounce up, like, waist high to Perez. Because he couldn't throw to first. Well, you don't get to go to the Hall of Fame if you can't throw the ball from shortstop to first base. I'm sorry.
Correct.
So, there's some great names on the 80s Cubs. Of course, we talked about Tim Blackwell.
Yep.
A handsome guy there.
Oof. With the handlebar mustache. Look him up, kids. It's easy to spell. He was the backup. Actually, in 1980 would be Barry Foote's probable career year. Best season, I'm sure. No, scratch that. That was 79. That was 79.
Yeah,
never
Barry
mind.
And then Blackwell, he was gone. Blackwell played 103 games. That was the most a catcher that year.
I'm clearly conflating 79 and 80. 79 had some good memories. 1980 really had very few.
Other catchers included the great Mike O'Berry. And Bill Hayes.
I remember him. Don't remember him. Do not remember Bill Hayes, but I do remember Michael Berry. Michael Berry may have been, and you know, I could be wrong, but he may have been in one of the top three prospect cards, like 1981 or, you know, 1982, one of those.
How many times did Bill Buckner strike out in 145 games? 615 plate appearances.
I can make an educated guess, because in a previous podcast we talked about how ridiculously low Bill Buckner's rate was in his career. Of course, his walk rate rate was low also, yes. But in 600 some at bats, I want to say 25.
He struck out 18 times.
In 18. We love Billy Buck.
Struck out three times a month, and he walked 30 times.
We love Billy Buck.
He walked five times a month.
Yeah, might as well mention now that around 1980. Screw that story. I just remembered Billy Buck was the National League batting champion in 1980. 324 average, my friends. There's another fun fact for you, a little after the fact. But yeah, first Cub batting champion in only like 4 years, because Madlock had done it back-to-back seasons. But then the Cubs would not have a batting champ until, I want to say, Derek Lee. Did Derek Lee win a batting champion for the Cubs, or am I just getting hazy? All right. I think he would have been the first. He would have been the first since Buckner, unless I've forgotten somebody else.
And then Frank Schwindel won it this year.
Right. This podcast is not taking place in 2023, but if it were, Frank Schwindel's name would be mentioned.
Yeah, we would look back on it.
First baseman, batting champs.
But Buckner, that was his 1980 was his 11th season in the big leagues. And he had never been an all-star. And he would not be an all-star until the next season, 1981. I'm sure because he had won
Right.
Won the batting title in 80, and he gets to be an all-star in 81.
The previous year, right. He
finished top 10 in MVP voting in 81 and 82. Finished 14th in 80.
Kind of an odd time to start reaching your peak, it would seem. And Buckner was always a good hitter. He was actually – he played in the 74 World Series as a left fielder for the Dodgers because apparently they thought Steve Garvey was a better first baseman.
Well, Buck was fast.
Correct, you're right.
He screwed up his feet.
He was like Mickey Mantle.
And Garvey was a complete non-athlete, so – you can see why they had
Buck. Well, I wouldn't say Garvey was a complete non-athlete, because I do believe Steve Garvey played football at Michigan State. He only played baseball there. And who the hell played baseball in college besides Carl Yastrzemski at Notre Dame and Steve Garvey at Michigan State? It was not a thing. So, fuck you, Steve Garvey.
It's just, he's so squatty and stiff looking. Right. Bad hair.
Bill Buckner had a fucking mustache that you could, you know, set your watch to. So,
yeah, Mike Tyson got the most games played at second base.
We've actually mentioned three cases of this, and I can't remember what the third one was, but we wrote it down. So far, we've mentioned Mike Tyson and Dave Roberts, in which there is a white and black Mike Tyson and a white and Dave. Black Dave Roberts. There's a third guy you mentioned that I forgot who it was that also has that dichotomy. So that's all I can add about Mike Tyson. That Dave Roberts you mentioned, I have a baseball card with him.
Oh, good.
Yeah, exciting stuff.
Shortstop was Ivan De Jesus, who would get traded for somebody. I don't remember who.
Yeah.
Stole 44 bases for the 1980s.
And then, of course, you always have to ask this question.
That's not so bad. 80s.
How many times did he get caught?
16.
Oh, not bad terrible. At all.
However, Lenny Randle, Lenny stole 19 bases. He got caught 13 times. That's not good.
That's more like it. That's more like 1980s baseball.
Yeah, but between Tyson and DeJesus, the Cubs middle infield had OPS pluses of 65 and 78. That's not good.
It was heady times.
Dave Kingman played 81 games in left field.
Malcontent. So Kingman, of course, is coming out. And this is like, Kingman was part of the allure for me. I mentioned the Rotund Herman Franks in late 79 when they're playing competitive games against the Pirates. But, of course, Dave Kingman, kind of a local area guy. He grew up in Oregon, but then emigrated to Illinois and graduated from Prospect High School. Was a first round pick in 68 and then couldn't field third base to save his life and just couldn't stop striking out, and back when strikeouts were unforgivable, and then somehow, you know, ended up after being with like seven different teams and is still in his 20s, he shows up in 79 and for his kind of hometown team, and he bashes 48 home runs. And that's when I got hooked. So I couldn't fucking wait for 1980 to start, because Dave Kingman, bro. And then Dave Kingman, this is probably the season in which a few things probably happened. They might be searchable on the internet, but one would be that Dave Kingman on Dave Kingman Day, which I'm pretty sure would have occurred in 1980, was not in attendance at Wrigley Field, but out on a boat on Lake Michigan. Might have been the same season in which he mailed a dead rat to a reporter. Not the greatest guy, you know. And then, yeah, and he was, it was kind of astonishing as an 8-year old to like see this guy that you kind of got a glimpse of the year before, bash all these homers, you know, going totally being in this weird 1979 version of a home run contest with Mike Schmidt, and like, you know, being this heroic offensive player and then just being this dickhead that everybody hated.
So a mutual friend of mine and Dave Kaplan, former NIU basketball coach John McDougal.
Ah, yes. I remember John McDougal.
He was a great guy. He coached junior high basketball, I guess in Mount Prospect, when he was young. And he had Dave Kingman was on his junior high basketball team.
Because Kingman, of course, also tall as fuck. For baseball, yep. Or basketball.
And I was talking to a coach, and he brought it up. And I said, oh, I said, was he a prick in junior high? And he goes, he absolutely was. He goes, he was a royal pain in the ass. That's what.
As a high school athlete?
As a junior high athlete. He said Dave Kingman was a pain in the ass. So
is he
did
just
not have fond memories of Dave Kingman, even as a... what was like a 12-year-old,
right. 13. So yeah, so even as a teenager, right? And somehow he's in his old age, maybe because he's desperate for money, somehow gone through some sort of a rehabilitation in the last 20. He's been at a Cubs convention, which would have been unthinkable, you know, a long time ago.
All right, so this we're going way out now. So there's a show on NBC called, it's not an old 80s spring break movie, it's called Making It.
And I remember hosted... Making It. Is that Tom Cruise? No, sorry. I'm sorry.
I was losing it. Making It is hosted by Amy Poehler and Nick Offerman. And what it is they bring makers, you know, people who make crafts and other stuff. And yep. It's a reality show where they compete. They whoever makes the best design, and they vote people off one at a time. And on the most, it's a good show. They make cool stuff, and Amy and Nick are funny. And Nick, of course, is a very accomplished woodworker. So he really
correct.
Knows
I've shit. Heard that. Yeah, it's not
also
just a
from,
shtick.
He's also from the Chicago suburbs.
Yeah, Manuka, south suburb. Yep.
And he's a Cub fan. And on the most recent season, there was a guy on there in his 20s who was making stuff, and Amy says, I think they only give you first names, and Amy says, oh, your dad is a famous baseball player. And Nick clearly didn't know who the guy was going to say his dad was. And he goes, yeah. He goes, my dad is Dave Kingman. And Nick is like, oh, my God. He goes, King Kong. He was my favorite player as a kid. He's going on and on and on. And then in perfect fashion, he's, you know, they're like, he's like, well, he said, your dad and I don't have the greatest relationship.
Wow.
And but at the end, I don't want to spoil it for people. The kid ends up winning. Like, he's the guy who wins the whole competition. And Dave is still married to this guy's mom. And they were there. And so he got to see Dave Kingman, modern day Dave Kingman. And, you know, telling, oh, how proud he was of his son and whatever, which was nice. But I'm sure it was just for TV. But I thought it was funny because, and they said Dave Kingman, I immediately rolled my head. And then when the kid's like, well, you know, Dad and I, we have kind of a complicated relationship. And I was like, of course you do.
Right. Your dad's a fucking asshole.
Dad's an asshole.
Right. And it's probably not been you know, any less subtle with all of the money he's made in his career. By the way, one last note on Dave Kingman. It kills me, and it's still there, but if you just Wikipedia Dave Kingman, the stock photo they use, I mean, you should do it while we're here. It's It probably defines his defensive prowess, just if you could, one snapshot.
Yeah, he looks like quite the athlete.
Is he? What is he? But he was an athlete. He's just was he an athlete or not? He was a tall guy. He played basketball. He was athletic in some level. You know, we know you don't have to be an athlete to play baseball, but he did play, you know, prep basketball. That picture, but he could not play left field. He was a terrible fucking outfit, especially by 1979, 1980. But it's almost like a Bigfoot sighting, this Wikipedia photo of Dave Kingman.
The 6'6 Kingman was a power hitter who twice led the National League in home runs. Known for his long home runs, Kingman hit one measured at over 530 feet. Okay, he struck out frequently and posted a low batting average and low on-base percentage.
Yes,
his 1,816 strikeouts was the fourth highest total in MLB history at the time of his retirement.
But he's probably not even top 10 anymore. 21st. Just like Jim Brown is like
down to 21st. I think Jose Hernandez caught him in one season.
Yes, yes. You know, Kingman did have a second act, though, even though he, you know, after his career high point of 48 homers or whatever for the Cubs the year before, he did find himself where he should have probably been all along in the American League as a DH for the A's. And he actually was kind of a part of a link to the Jose Canseco era, because when Canseco came up, I believe Kingman was still in Oakland.
Yeah, Kingman played for the A's till 86. Into the 86 season.
And he basically bashed himself into the argument. It wasn't much of an argument because nobody bought it. But he was at one point, and this is probably not true anymore, but he was the only player with 400 home runs who was not a Hall of Famer.
Not a Hall of Fame.
And there was a time when most 300 home run hitters were Hall of Famers. So, yeah.
So the aforementioned Jerry Martin played center field. And Mike Vail is the guy they listed as the right fielder.
Yeah, I mentioned Mike Vail was betting cleanup in that Dodgers game I was at.
Well, of course, he had six homers and 47 RBIs with a 423 slug, which was like the fourth best on the team, I think.
Well, I'm not going to suggest, of course, that Mike Vail was batting cleanup every day. I'm sure the game I was at was an anomaly, you know.
That's quite a group. I can see how – I don't know how they won 64 games. Yeah, Larry Bittner hit 249 with a 294 on base. Steve Dillard.
Oh, another favorite Cub. You know, this might be Steve Dillard's first mention, and I got to tell you, I mean, we've done, we've already indicated coming into this 15 podcasts. I don't know if Steve Dillard's name has come up three times, if at all. And I have to say, for you know, being a weird fan, and maybe I brought it up in this context, but for a brief period of time, Steve Dillard and his probable 244 career on-base percentage was like kind of like my favorite, kind of like even as a 9-year-old, my favorite hipster Cub player. Like everybody loved Buckner. We all like him. You try to glom onto guys, and I'm like, yeah, Steve Dillard. He's got a mustache you can really, you know, take a slide on. I mean, like, just like he's like a funny looking guy. I think he's had a kid that also made it to the big leagues recently, but. Since you brought him up, it did not happen in 1980, and I heard this on the radio with Vince Lloyd and Lou Boudreau, but Steve Dillard was once picked off of first base without sliding into first base, nice. And Vince Lloyd had to point that out. So,
whoops.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if Steve – I knew Jim – I thought Jim – I was going to go with Steve Dillard in my five facts when I went with Jim Tracy making his debut.
Now, I can tell you that the next guy on here – is a guy that I, as a kid, assumed there was a typo on his baseball card.
Who'd
I remember asking my dad, like, look, they spelled this guy's name wrong. And dad's like, no, that's how he spells it. And that would be Scott with one T, Thompson.
Yes.
Yeah. Even as a young child, I was like, no, that's not right. There's two T's in Scott.
The opening day, which I'm not even looking at, but it might have been against the Expos. I'll look at it now because I think Woody Fryman, former Cub, played I don't think it was, but the opening day center fielder 19. And again, I'm saying this like it's the truth, but it could be wrong. I believe was Carlos Lascano. Okay. And I know that really upset my dad because he was a big Scott Thompson fan. And even though Scott Thompson probably played more games like in the corner infield than center field, that, you know, that he thought that Scott Thompson should have been the center fielder. And of course, it turned out to be Jerry Martin, who led the Cubs in homers again with 23, which was half as many as the previous season's
home. I'll tell you, you know, you've had a quality big league career, and that is when you spend the first 6 years of your career on the same team, and yet you have three different numbers.
Scott Thompson?
25, 29, and 18, which means you got sent down, somebody better got your number, and when you came back, they just gave you a different one.
That's it.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I was totally wrong about Woody Fryman in opening day in 1980, but I will say that Carlos Lascano was the opening day center fielder in Shea Stadium in 1980, and of course, Jerry Martin came in. So, I don't know. You know, my dad at that point, he had five kids and had yet to send the first one to college, which we all did. You know, he may have been drinking a little bit because maybe Scott Thompson was not really in the contention for center field because Martin came into the game. I think Lascano was our hope because do you remember Carlos Lascano had a brother, much more successful brother?
He had six toes.
That's right.
Six toe Lascano.
Six was Lascano. Yeah, because the Brewers had some weird run in the late 70s where all of a sudden they were not awful, and Sixto was kind of part of it.
All right, here's a guy I don't understand.
Yeah, Carlos.
I don't understand why he was on the team. And they traded for him during the season. So Bill Buckner played 145 games at first base. Why would you trade for Cliff Johnson, who was enormous and could only play first base?
Because Cliff Johnson broke Goose Gossage's thumb when both were members of the Yankees. Does that make you happy?
It does. No, what I happened? Just I feel bad for Cliff. You get traded to a team that has you can only play one position, and the team you get traded to, their first baseman is winning the batting title.
Right. Well, you know what? Cliff Johnson, I don't know how he appears in baseball reference. My memory of Cliff Johnson was, A, when the Cubs traded for him, we learned he must be a badass because he broke Goose Gossage's thumb. All right, that's the first thing I think of. That's why I brought it up. The other one was that Cliff Johnson, I want to say, may have hit two grand slams after his arrival in 1980. And they may have also both been pinch hit grand slams. But the third fact I want to mention, especially in light of, the seeming affront to Bill Buckner that you bring up, Andy, is that I have no recollection of Cliff Johnson playing first. I swear, though, I remember him bumbling around in the outfield and making some ridiculous catch against the ivy where he fell over and his hat fell off, in which there was absolutely positively no way that it would have held up under replay review today. Like I remember like watching the replay with Jack Brickhouse and you could just clearly see the ball like right in front of him as he, picked it
all
up.
Right. So Cliff played 68 games at first base for the Cubs.
He did, huh? Okay.
Bill Buckner played 54 games in the outfield.
In 1980?
Yeah, and I'm sure that was graceful.
Can't help you with that.
Cliff played three games, he played 14 innings in the outfield.
It's so ridiculous because Cliff Johnson was already
this?
Kind of a DH.
Oh, this is great.
He was already the kind of a DH kind of a guy, though. Like what? And Bill Buckner was a borderline Gold Glover. It doesn't make any sense.
Cliff caught an inning in 1980.
I remember that he was he was an emergency catcher. Yes. That was a fact. I do remember.
He could not wait to get out of there. He had 235. He had 10 homers in just 196 at bats.
Yeah, I kind of loved him. Yeah,
he drove in 34 runs in 68 games.
Yeah.
Jesus Figueroa
hit his only career homer in 1980.
Yeah, one homer, 11 RBIs.
And there's no way you can corroborate this, but it fell into the right field basket. So his only career homer, barely. Loved Jesus Figueroa, and he was also, I believe, traded for the opening day second baseman in 1981, Joe Strain, Strain, who was fucking awful.
So we talked about Barry Foote. We talked about Jim Tracy. Unless you have more Jim Tracy stories,
I do because I was at his debut. So I don't know the game. You can find it there. But and this is a quick story, not nearly as engaging as Bill Russell turning a win into a loss. Only that we were in the bleachers again. Don't remember the circumstances. Don't know if Uncle Bud was involved, but we had a scorecard and they had to announce that there is a player, like a mystery player on the Cubs, but he's not in your scorecard.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was it. And he started that day, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure you can pull it up. Jim Tracy's debut. I can just tell you I was there because I guarantee you I was there because it was so fresh that he was not even in those scorecards that I've referenced and that I've already provided you of a screenshot of at the Bill Russell game. Also, Cubs Dodgers, or no, I'm sorry, no, I got confused. Jim Tracy was a future Dodgers manager, but I don't know who they were playing when the Cubs, when he made his debut, but nevertheless, Jim Tracy in the starting lineup, not in your program. That's all I got.
Do you remember Ken Henderson?
I do. He was a White Sox in the 70s, a white guy. And they got rid of Ken Henderson, then brought in Steve Henderson, I think, in the Kingman trade or maybe or something. And Steve Henderson was a black guy. Ken Henderson didn't do much for the Cubs in 1980.
He made his big league debut in 1965. Playing for the San Francisco Giants, who with among his teammates that day were two of the Alou brothers, Maddie and Jesus, Willie Mays and Willie McCovey.
Wow.
And he was still playing in 1980 when he was not playing with Willie Mays or Willie McCovey on the 80 Cubs.
So he actually had a pretty good career if he played that long.
Let's see. He played 16 seasons.
He was a White Sox, right? Or am I over my skis?
Yes, from 73 to 75. Yeah, he had a pretty good career. He had 257, 343, 396. He had 106 OPS plus.
I'm assuming like half this roster, this was Ken Henderson's last stop in the major leagues, or did he
actually... Yeah, this was it. These were his final 44 games.
I think that he's not the only one.
Playing out the string for the Cubs. And judging from his picture, I can tell he was not Steve Henderson's brother.
Just wanted to... I only bring that up because I was a kid. I'm trying to process this. I'm 8 years old. We got Ken Henderson. Now we got Steve Henderson. Oh, that's a different guy. Of course, he looks different, so... Yeah, just trying to keep my years straight. That's all.
A guy who had a hell of a year in 1980 for the Cubs was one of Frank's favorites, Mick Kelleher.
Yes, we've talked some serious Mick Kelleher.
In 105 games for the 1980 Cubs, Mick Kelleher posted an OPS plus. Now remember, 100 is league average. Mick Kelleher played more than 100 games for the Cubs. He posted an OPS plus of 9. .146, .217. He slugged .177. Now, I don't know. Was he like a pinch runner? He must have been a defensive replacement. He only batted 96 times in 105 games. More games played than at bats. But
folks,
bad.
In case you missed our 1970s.
17 total bases playing a full season in the big leagues.
In case you missed our 1977 special edition podcast with Frank Nova of the 1977 Cubs, and if you listen on Spotify, just search 1977 Cubs, and you will find more hilarious tales of Mick Kelleher, including a brawl with future teammate Dave Kingman, which occurred when Kingman was with the Mets.
So to compare the 9 that Mick put up, Mike Kruko, OPS plus 53. Now, Rick Rushell, who we remember as a surprisingly good athlete,
correct,
did not have a good year at the plate in 1980. He hit 159, he had no homers, 5 RBIs, struck out 23 times, and he had an OPS plus of 5.
Mick beat him.
But remember, he was not being paid to hit. I guess Mick wasn't either.
Well, neither was Mike Kruko. Mike Kruko.
Yeah, Kruk, 246, 269, 292.
I had no recollection of Kruko being a good
A homer and 6 RBIs. He only struck out 12 times in 34 games.
Wow. Okay. He had as many career homers as his broadcast partner then.
Oh, he's got more.
He might have more. Right. That's only 1980 that he homered.
Let's look him up quick.
Yeah.
Kruk.
That's true. He might have twice as many homers as his position playing broadcast partner.
5 times as many. 5 homers, 54 RBIs.
I'm sure this been brought up on the Giants
in 1979 for the Cubs. He hit .314. He had an OPS plus of 93 in 51 at bats. He had a homer, 8 RBIs, only struck out 8 times. He didn't strike out. struck out 194 times in 819 plate appearances. I mean, for a pitcher, we'll never get to see it anymore.
I never knew Kruko was such a good hitting pitcher. Holy cow. Yeah. Wow.
He's one of my, I barely remember him as a player. Although he did play pitch in the first game I ever, in fact, he was in line for the win and the Cubs blew his save.
The game that you've already teased, the one that you've teased us with, which we'll get to.
But the reason I like Mike so much is, and we talked about it before, so we don't need to belabor the point. He is one of my all time favorite sports announcers.
Correct. Well, I was wondering as we're going through this, that must have been discussed on the broadcast between him and Kuiper that Kruko is a pitcher has five times.
I would guess if they've been working together for 30 years. I'll bet it's come up a thousand times.
Oh, fuck yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Anytime. Awesome. I can tell you that anytime Steve Stone's name comes up, the two of them have a nice chuckle because it would have been a former teammate of Kruko's, right? Didn't he pitch? Did he ever play for the White Sox? No, the Giants. With the Giants, they would have been teammates.
Kruko came up with the Cubs. He was a Giant in the 80s.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he almost won the Cy Young in 86.
Not even that. They were almost different eras.
All right, so
actually.
Not teammates.
So Stoney only figures into the Kuiper part of it, but still.
Right, but anytime Steve comes up, and because he's an active announcer, he does come up. And Kruk tees up Kuiper, and Kuiper talks about the 500-foot home run he hit off of Steve Stone, which actually was 308 feet that scraped the
probably
top of the wall. In fact,
clear the fence.
Kuiper has joked that he never got to do a home run trot because he's like, I didn't know what one felt like. I hit the ball, I started running.
And just to tie a bow on Mike Krugo's career at the Cubs, he was like a pretty good pitcher on a shitty team. And then he was part of Dallas Green's overhaul. One of the guys that we got, I believe Keith Moreland might have been, we got him in return for Kruko. I might be mixing up my Cubs-Phillies trades. But then he resurfaced with the Giants, and he threw a complete game. I think earlier on a podcast we talked about this, and I said he threw a shutout like Ray Burris did in 81, but he didn't. I looked it up. It was a complete game. He did allow a run. But it was kind of cool. I remember watching that one. I think it was against the Cardinals, too. It would have been 87. Kruko went the distance in a playoff game, but not that memorable because the Cubs are so terrible. Not like I don't remember him badly. He was a pretty good pitcher on a shitty team, so you didn't really know.
It's funny. He was eighth round pick of the Cubs out of Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
Jeez. Well, who was the other guy that was?
I was just making fun of. Like I just started going Cal Poly whatever. He got traded on December 8th, 1981 with cash, not Norm Cash or Dave Cash, just cash, to the Phillies for Dan Larson, Keith Moreland, and the great Dickie Knowles.
Yes.
And he was traded from the Phillies a year later to the Giants with C.L. Penninger, whoever that is, and Mark Davis. Is this future Cy Young Award winner?
Yes, 1989 for the Padres.
Yep. For Al Holland and future Hall of Famer Joe Morgan.
Wow. I'm sorry. I'm more amazed the fact that I believe that was Al Holland's second reference in this very podcast.
Yeah, and Joe Morgan's sixth.
Well, of course, but Joe Morgan's going to come up. But see, kids, you start tuning in. We're going to do a lot of 80s. You're going to hear more Al Hollands in case you just can't get enough.
Yeah, Mike Kruko in 86 with the Giants, 20-9.
He won 20 games?
A 3.05 ERA. Only gave up 204 hits, 245 innings.
Damn.
He was an all-star, and he was third in Cy Young voting.
Jesus Christ. How did I win it, right?
No, Mike Scott, Fernando Valenzuela, and Mike Kruko.
I would have thought I would have remembered such a season from Mike Kruko. Jesus Christ, I have no recollection of that awesomeness. Good for him. I always liked Kruko.
He only had
what a monster season. I had no idea.
Yeah, just to show how baseball was different. He had 1, 2, 3, 4. He had 5 seasons where he won 10 or more games. Only 2 of those were winning seasons.
Wow, you're right.
That's what you get when you pitch for the Cubs and then the early 80s Giants. Yeah. By 86, they were okay. Obviously, they would.
Well, right. And then, like I said, in 87, yeah, 87, he was doing all he could to take him to the pen. He went the distance in a playoff game. So,
let's see. We're almost out of guys here.
Too bad.
Steve Ontiveros.
Oh. Brought it up once before, but my cousin Tom had gone up to Montreal around probably 1980 to watch the Cubs with his wife, and they were on the artificial turf, and Steve Ontiveros, of course, the third baseman that the Cubs settled on after Bill Madlock.
Yep.
Used to, you might associate him with having a huge chew in his mouth. And that on the artificial turf, Tom would say that all the way from the upper deck, you could see a huge brown spot just to the left of like the third base dirt area. And then, of course, I can be remiss for all the local guys, the Chicago guys that from the 70s and 80s, if I didn't mention Steve Ontiveros' marketing contribution to Hairline Creations, I believe, or Paul Finnemore, perhaps I would. Couldn't remember. It was always like in the local TV guide. You got the newspaper with Steve Ontiveros very proudly wearing plugs 30 years before, you know, Brian Urlacher or Ryan Sandberg. Is Ian Happ on that too, or am I seeing him on billboards for something else? Is he selling weed? I can't keep it straight.
No, I think he's a restore guy. I think he honestly. I don't know thanks to the pandemic. I don't know the last time I've been to the airport, because that's where you see all the signs. You gotta drive by O'Hare.
I got cataracts, and I drive, so hey, sorry, but like I can't quite pick it out, but it looks like Ian Happ to me. So, all right.
I think it is. I think he is doing one.
Okay. So, yeah, Steve Ontiveros.
Another
was
reason
the restore.
The Cubs won't trade him. Now he's one of the.
Right, right.
Oh, I know. The corporate partners love it.
Basically, yeah. Steve Ontiveros is the Ian Happ of 1980. It adds up. It's apples to apples, people.
Do you remember Steve Mecko?
Of course I do, because Steve Mecko was a very sort of an Irish tragedy. He's not Irish, but it's just, you know, I'm just accentuating it. Steve Mecko had come up and then got taken out on a double play by Bill Madlock in a game in either late 1979 or 1980. And Madlock's hard slide apparently gave Steve Mecko cancer, from which he died about 2 years later. I'm using a little bit of hyperbole.
Gave him cancer, yeah.
Yes, he did. It was pointed out that there was a hard slide that young Steve Mecko absorbed, and somehow mysteriously, shortly afterwards. I'm joking, of course. I love Bill Madlock. He actually follows me, and I only have like 480 followers on Twitter. Bill Madlock is awesome. I'm not denigrating. I'm not making fun of him. I'm just saying it's, you know, Bill Madlock. In fact, I'm celebrating Bill Madlock because he slid so hard. But Steve Mecko was a little bit hurt. Didn't matter. But not, you know, later on the next year, he would come up and down. There was a baseball card with Steve Mecko on it, but he was not like it's projected to be a huge prospect. So it's just more of a sad story that he was, a guy that got a cup of coffee, played a little bit, and then he caught cancer, and he was, you know, probably died at like 24, 25. It was a very somber thing. I remember as a kid.
Yeah. 27.
Poor Steve Mecko.
Played his final game. In on what date here?
Was it 80?
August 6th, 1980, and he was he died on November 15th, 1981.
Wow. Yeah. And then So yes, I remember Steve Mecko.
He was a fifth round draft pick of the Cubs in 1977.
Yeah, I remember like reacclimating myself with a Steve Mecko story on the internet like 10 years. Somebody published something from a local paper.
Here's a good tidbit about the draft that honestly didn't change until maybe 20 years ago. If you weren't a first round draft pick, you didn't know what round you got picked in. They purposely did that to try to blunt the leverage guys would have, because they're, you know, you could be a second round pick, and they could just act like you were like the 18th round pick.
Who ran the draft? Monty Hall.
It was done they used to draft on a conference call that only the teams were on, and they also, until recent years, the draft ended when every team stopped picking. So, like, that's how, like, Mike Piazza went in the 61st round. The Dodgers just kept picking players. And they might have been the only team picking by, like, the 54th round. And they would be like, once you passed in a round, you were done.
But so you, one team could like get like seven picks in a row just by.
Yeah, and we're not done. You might we're be the done. Only team left picking.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, there was all kinds of weird shit. Now there was a dickhead at Northern who got drafted. He dated my girlfriend before I did. got drafted by the Brewers and didn't know what round he'd been drafted in. And then obviously, then at some point after most of the guys have signed, they put the list out. And he was like he was a left-handed pitcher, so he was going to get picked by somebody, even though he wasn't very good. It was like the 48th round he got picked in. Because she's like, oh, okay. Jesse got drafted. I'm like, oh, that's great. By who? The French Foreign Legion? The Brewers. Oh, well, same shit.
Yeah.
I think he pitched like in rookie ball 1 year, and then he was gone. Best thing I remember about him was his roommate got super drunk one night and came into the room and got confused and thought he was in the bathroom and pissed all over Jesse's closet. One of the things in Jesse's closet was his baseball uniform, and he had a game the next day and didn't know that his roommate had done that and grabbed his stuff and threw it in the bag and then realized that he was probably going to need a different uniform.
He should count his blessings and be happy that Najee Davenport
right. put that stuff in the hamper.
Make his way.
Najee, you got to poop in into it. His uniform. Let's see.
I'm just glad that Cliff Johnson came up tonight because I would not have remembered that, and the memories came flooding back.
We didn't talk about all the pitchers because you kind of crapped out, and I was going over the.
We started with the relievers and the inordinate amount of historic relievers that the 1980 yes. Cubs had.
So we talked about Bruce Sutter just a little bit. Oh, you want to talk about the? Did you want to talk about the trade? Is this?
No,
he's there one more year, right? He's there in 81?
No, this is his last season. Okay, so real quick. First of all, Bruce Sutter in 77 broke onto the scene with this crazy-ass split-fingered fastball, and nobody could touch it. And this is evidenced by the following fact, that in four consecutive All-Star games, the first three of which he was a member of the Cubs. So 1978, 1979, 1980, and then, of course, 1981 as a Cardinal. Bruce Sutter got a win, and then a save in the All-Star game. The fucking American League with all your Robin Younce and your George Brett's and your they could not even come. It was amazing. And like we're Cub fan in 1980, you could look it up at the All-Star game. He got a win or a save. It would have been a save because I think it went win-win, save. In four consecutive All-Star games, Bruce Sutter got a win-win, save. And, folks, it wasn't a bullshit vulture win where he blew a save. It was an All-Star game where he came in a tie game, I'm pretty sure. There's no way fucking Bruce Sutter's All-Star numbers were probably ridiculous. And it just accentuates how unique it was that he was you know, he just had this pitch that hadn't really been seen before. People couldn't adjust to it right away. And, of course, he's toiling for the 64 and 98 Cubs. And, you know, but he was the best. He was like the, you know, we mentioned Raleigh Fingers, right, is one of the 10 ever MVP and All-Stars. And Fingers really was, he was the first Hall of Fame closer. You know, closers are a thing that have only existed really practically in the last 60 years. Fingers was legit. Sparky Lyle won a Cy Young in 76. Gossage was known. I mean, there were closers were, there, but Sutter really sort of took the saves to the next level. And of course, this is still originally in the two and three inning save. It was incredible. And so he's another one along with like Kingman and Russell, these guys that when you're 8, 9 years old and you're watching him, Sutter was absolutely up there.
Yeah. So he pitched 5 years for the Cubs, 4 years for the Cardinals, and 3 years for the Braves. And his best run was with the Cubs. He had a 2.39 ERA. He had 133 saves.
133 saves between like what 1976 and 1980?
76 and 80. Yep. He led the National League in saves 5 out of 6 seasons, 2 of those with the Cubs and 3 of those with the Cardinals. His final season with the Cardinals was 84 when he's most famous for giving up 2 home runs to Ryan Sandberg in a game. It's probably Well, no, 77 might have been his best season. 134 ERA, 31
statistically.
Saves.
But he won the Cy Young in 79 for yes. just under 500 team.
Yeah.
And
he had 37 saves for a team that won what? 80 games?
Pretty much, yep. Yeah, so like you brought up in the past, like what a dumb trade it was. And like there's some validity to it, but like what were they going to do with that hood ornament? They had Lee Smith on the staff and they got Leon Durham. Like,
but why do you trade him to the Cardinals?
That's what bothers you. The yes. other thing is, yes. I have to mention this. I only remember this because my dad would point it out. I remember this as a kid. Bruce Sutter fucking took the Cubs arbitration after 79.
As was his collectively fucking, bargained right.
Absolutely. And I think he actually did it after 79, going into 80. So the Cubs, and of course, let's bring up the fact, of course, this is the second to last season of a 70-year run.
Is still salty Saltwell? Is he
well, no, but it's off? Wrigley, but it's Wrigley ownership, and it's not even P.K. Wrigley. It's the son who had even less interest in the team than his father, and both parents had died, and he's like, you know, he's incentivized to sell the team anyway, and holy fuck, he's got to pay this all-star, you know, like more money. Because Sutter won arbitration. Arbitration was kind of a new thing. So it was like, so they bristled it. Sutter justifiably earned a big-ass raise in 1980, and that also led to his departure. But again, it's not a what-if. You know, it doesn't matter because the Cubs are in such fucking disarray because the Wrigley family was at the absolute end of an already four-decade run of disinterested management, and so...
Well, the guy who really got screwed was Ted Turner, because in 84,
he did get screwed.
154 ERA, he led the league in saves with 45, 63 games finished.
This and is in 80. In 85, he had 40?
No, in 84. Right. Yep. And then he goes into free agency, signs a big deal with the Braves, which he's still being paid for. That's one
today,
of those weird annuity things. He's still getting paid.
Bobby Bonilla. Wow. Wow. Well, I remember at the time, it was like the biggest contract.
So the terms of the contract were, it was 6 years. This is funny. 6 years, $10 million, which at the time was like, holy shit. And he only pitched in three of those years for the Braves. And in one of those years, he only pitched. How many times?
I was surprised to hear you mention 3 years. I thought it was like
he really pitched. Sorry, Luke.
He's trying to correct you.
Well, I made
parts of three. Parts of 3 years. It's all right. It's more of a.
He pitched in 85. He pitched 58 games. 86, he only pitched in 16, missed all of 87.
Came back in 88 because he felt guilty about taking Mr. Turner's money.
Right. Pitched 38 more and he was done.
38 and 88? Jesus, that's admirable because his arm was probably hanging by, like, you know, shoestring and bubblegum.
14 saves. Yeah, so his ERA with the Cubs was 2.39. His ERA with the Cardinals was 2.72. His ERA with the Atlanta was 4.55.
Oh man, still made the Hall of Fame.
And he was only 32 when he signed with the.
Well, but we've talked about it before when we talked about the only other season in this decade that we covered, 89, and Roger Craig and the San Francisco Giants, and Craig sort of like, made an assembly line out of. You know, the split finger fastball, which is what Bruce Sutter was most famous for when he broke onto the scene. And all of those pitchers on the Giants blew their arms out.
Yep.
Right?
That's yeah, it broke two things. It broke sharply downward and it broke your elbow. Those are the two things.
So, and, you know, if it wasn't, had he not made the Hall of Fame, you'd almost suggest that Bruce Sutter's yeoman effort for not just the 1980 Cubs, but several Cubs teams of that era would have been in vain because, Jesus, they sucked. And he was saving games still left
and
right. Yeah,
the only guy on those Roger Craig teams that I think that didn't throw it was Russell, right? I mean, of like the start.
Yeah, because he was a reclamation project to begin with.
I'm not throwing that thing. Screw that.
Right. I've already... I've already seen video of my elbow getting cut into.
So he talked about a little bit about Preston Gomez. He started the season as the Cubs manager, and he did not finish it.
And yeah, Joey Amalfitano, by the way, when Herman Franks like blew up at the last week of the previous season, they brought out a good old reliable third base coach, Joey Amalfitano, to finish out the season. They told Joey after the season, no, you go back, and then we got this guy, but you can stay, and you can be our third base coach again. And then they bring in Preston, and we were very, you know, maybe not excited, but.
What's dinging?
That's me. I'm sorry. I was looking to see if I was.
So Preston managed the Padres, the Astros, and the Cubs. He got fired in season by all three teams. And the best was in 1972, because you figure, oh, I mean, he got fired his first season with the Cubs, and he'd only managed 90 games. Like, well, that's not, you can give him a fair shake. The 1972 Padres, he got fired after 11 games. And he was replaced by Don Zimmer. Who knew that Don Zimmer? I didn't know Don Zimmer even managed the Padres. Let's see. Preston got, let's see when the Astros fired him. That was 1975, and he got replaced by Bill Verdon. But, yikes. So I think that's about all we can do with the 1980 Cubs. So, like I said, I only have a cursory memory of that. I certainly remember individual players from the 80 Cubs, but I don't remember that season at all. And now that we've relived it, I'm kind of glad that I don't remember it. So anyway, it was nice to finally dip into the 80s. We got a lot more of those left. And at some point, we will tackle the mother of them all, the 1984 Cubs. But until then, we will see you guys later, the next time we remember some crap. So thanks a lot, guys. Thanks, Mike.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Many of us have herpes.